And I need help. So he's
the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Division for Wednesday, March 25th, 2015 will come to order. We have a quorum, so Senator Bach, you may begin with Senate File 49.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do have, this is the first committee, I do have an A1 amendment to get the bill into shape.
The A1 amendment is in the packet, members. So Senator Ingebretson will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, here's the situation. We have a whole group, I think, Senator Lockesmo can correct me if I'm wrong, I think 9 designated sites along the north shore of Lake Superior that in statute are called safe harbors. And we built a boat launch a number of years ago between Duluth and two harbors called McQuaid Row. And so we built a breakwater, a place for people to launch boats. There's no ancillary development around it. It is just purely a safe harbor. If somebody's out boating, it gives them the opportunity to get in out of the weather off of Lake Superior. It gives people an opportunity to launch a boat between two harbors or Knife River and Duluth. There's no other place to launch a boat there. The Army Corps of Engineers participated with us, as they have in all the other harbor developments along Lake Superior. But for some reason, their money didn't come in a timely way, and the state ended up paying a larger share than we should have in the development of that. So the Army Corps money came in later, and I actually had a provision, it came in, I think, probably last summer, I had a provision in last year's bonding bill that would have grabbed this money before it came to the state, and directed it to safe harbors on the shore, which is what it should have happened. And somehow in the negotiations of the bonding bill, the House was not opposed to it. It kind of, as language, fell out of the bill when the final bill and people were looking at all of the projects. Representative Hausman actually came to me a couple days later, very, very apologetic. We didn't have a problem with it. It just kind of fell out of the bill because it wasn't one of the projects that cost money. So we weren't able to get the money before the Army Corps sent it to us because it wasn't in the bill. It has since then showed up, I believe.
That's correct.
And because there's no language directing it, it went to the general fund, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lockesmo from DNR. We've received this money, and right now it's just basically sitting in an account at DNR, but it needs to be directed to a specific account so we could spend it.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's the situation. We'd like to put money in the Safe Harbors program. So the amendment actually gives the department an opportunity to spend it on any one of 3 projects on the North Shore, either the Knife River Marina, the one that's going to be developed at two harbors, or there is need for a new boat launch at the harbor up in Grand Marais. I actually was up there this summer and took a look at what they'd like to do there. So this would just give the department the opportunity to work with whichever one of those projects is more likely to be ready and spend the money there. So, Mr. Chairman, that's
pretty any questions what or I comments have to say about. Of the author of Mr. Boxwell. Okay, members, we're going to reserve the right to consider this as a layover for the omnibus bill, but in the meantime, we're going to send it out of here to finance, and finance is going to probably refer it to capital investment just in case we have a bonding bill. So that'd be the right place to put it, but just in case we don't have a bonding bill, we reserve the right to keep it here. So Senator Dibble will make that motion. Okay, on the Dibble motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Senator Bach, you have another one?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I have Senate File 520. And I actually have a couple visual aids for you in your packet that, for those of you that aren't familiar with snowmobiles, you can see the actual size of one of these small little snowmobiles that under current law requires the same registration as a large one that people ride on trails. Oftenly, kind of the generic name for them is Kitty Cat. I think that's because Arctic Cat probably made the very first ones. But all manufacturers make them. Most of them are like 120 cc's. They go about 8 miles an hour. And they're very expensive toys that parents buy for their kids to kind of introduce them to the sport of snowmobiling. They really get used around the yard or the field, or maybe if you live on the lake, around the dock, to get young people acquainted with the sport of snowmobiling, kind of develop some of that hand-eye coordination that it takes to run a snowmobile. And but under current law, they have to be registered like a regular one, pay the trail sticker. And it just seems like, one, I think very few of them actually are registered currently. Matter of fact, I know a rep over in the house that had one for years for his son who said, gee, I never registered mine. So I think...
don't say any names.
Mr. Franzen from MNUSA could probably have some thoughts about how often they're registered, but it seems like they don't get used on the trails. Why should they have to pay for the enforcement, the grooming, and other trail costs that normally should be incurred by people that use the trails? So this just would allow no registration fee, or this actually would allow a $6 registration fee on them, I'm sorry, as it's drafted. And there is, it was amended, I believe, in the policy committee to a lower CC number that more recognizes what they're, how they currently are made. Conversations with the DNR and with MNUSA, sounds like there's some interest in just saying, let's just not charge them a registration fee at all, that maybe the paperwork of giving them a $6 registration fee like collector snowmobiles have is more paperwork than the $6 is worth. So I guess I'd like you to consider that if this is going to be something that ends up in the omnibus bill, that maybe no registration might be a better solution than the $6 fee that we actually have in the bill. But with that, Mr. Chairman, that's my conclusion.
Senator Buck, regarding the lowering it to 125, we have an A1 amendment here that does that, so maybe they didn't do that in the policy committee.
Well, it could be. Okay. Well, if you have the amendment, then maybe we need to put it on here to get the CCs
Senator Dibble moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, and then Senator Bach, we'll just lay over Senate File 520 for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chairman, can Mr. Franzen from MNUSA earn his
speech? Mr. Franzen may speak, yes.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Are you in favor of this?
My name is Doug Franzen. I represent the Minnesota United Snowmobile Association, and we urge your support for this legislation. It's a real good idea. We would also urge this committee to strongly consider eliminating any registration on these, as Senator Beck says, toys, for a couple reasons. First of all, I think it will promote, it'll get the kids away from the Nintendos and outside where they really belong. But as importantly, we're kind of jealous about our snowmobile dedicated fund. And by our best reckoning, it would cost more to administer a $6 fee than it would to than the revenue. The expense of administration would exceed the $6 revenue. So it would be our recommendation that there be no registration fees on snowmobiles 125 cc's or less.
They don't have some kind of little GPS screen on them so the kids can play on them, or do they? They don't have something like that. The Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what kind of numbers are we talking about for the kitty cats? I know exactly what Senator Bach, and unfortunately he's put the video or the graphic on here with the one way in the background. That's the one I actually grew up on, and that's really an old snowmobile. But nevertheless, they've come a long ways from sitting on the back of those old things to even the kitty cats. But how many kitty cats are we talking about? And they're not allowed on trails, are they?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, second question first. No, they are not allowed on trails. They should not be allowed on trails, and that's primarily a safety issue.
Right.
You don't have the size or the horsepower to successfully participate in trail riding on one of these machines. Secondly, I don't have the sales figures, and the DNR does not have any reliable registration numbers. So the honest answer is we don't know how many of these are out there. By the way, the DNR collects registration information. You cannot separate out these small machines. So they don't know exactly, and as Senator Bach said, at least with one House member, and I know personally, that there are a lot of parents simply do not register these sleds anyway.
Mr. Chair, that's primarily just private property buzzing around and this and that. So thank you. That's all.
Okay, any further comments or questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm told that if you go on Craigslist or on eBay, you can find a lot of these because families grow out of them. The kids grow up, and they look to sell them. So they actually hang around to quite a while. Their life expectancy is probably much longer than a regular sled because, you know, they don't get ridden a lot, and they get passed kind of from one family to the neighbor or to a friend or get sold to somebody.
Okay. So people who have these don't have that, we might need them again someday for the grandkids attitude. They try and actually get rid of them. Sounds like it. Okay. All right, Senator Bach, we'll lay over Senate File 520 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Scoia. Senator Scoia, Senate File 945.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm going to have an amendment that I need to offer once I walk through the bill. Mr. Chair and members, the Senate File 945 is a continuation of the discussion that we've had for a number of years now with regard to the fees that are being charged for having the utilities cross state land, for example, going to a home for a phone line or an electric line. Those fees were increased dramatically in the mid-2000s, probably late 2000s, and ever since we've been working to reduce and eliminate those fees. What this bill does is clarifies that the fee is not to be charged when we're crossing public land, but on line 111 through 114, we're clarifying that this provision applies to small telephone lines and electric power lines that are under 100 kilovolts, and it does not apply to the large electric power lines, cables, conduits. And then I would like to ask Mr. Knopf for some clarification on line 114. The way this is written, mains or pipelines for gas, liquids, or solids, would that include natural gas lines going to a resident or a small business?
Mr. Knopf, do you have an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, I don't know if I have an opinion on that. It's not completely clear whether it would whether it would not include those.
You want to include them?
No, I do. I want them to be exempt also. I think the large main pipelines should pay the fee, but not these smaller lines as they're servicing a resident or a small business. That would be consistent with what I'm doing with regard to the smaller scale electric and phone lines.
You need language? Make sure.
That's what I was asking Mr. Knopf, if he had some language.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoia, yeah, just for now, we can hear later, but if you took out mains or pipelines and just put main pipelines, I mean, just for now, and work with the department, too, on how they would interpret that. So it would be delete mains or pipelines and just delete mains or and insert main.
Yes, I would move an oral amendment to delete mains or and insert main.
Okay, so everybody understand the oral amendment by Senator Scoia on line 1.14? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Motion adopted. Okay, Senator Scoia, you have an A1 amendment also.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment. And what this amendment does is there are a number of fees that are charged when lines are crossing public land. Talked to the advocates, and they would like this to apply just to the application fees. There are permanent school fund impacts, game and fish fund impacts, and I don't want to impact those. They said that those fees were reasonable. The fees that had gotten so far out of line were the application fees, and so I'd offer the A1 amendment.
And we have, apparently based on the amendment, we have a fiscal note also. So, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm handing out a copy of the fiscal note that the House was using for House File 572, and their fiscal note does take into account the amendment that Senator Scoy is offering right now, which basically there's a little bit a net increase of revenue now with the bill. Some new people would pay and some other people would be exempt, but then so there's a little bit of a cross out between the two. You can see on page 3 of the fiscal note, the box there sort of highlights there'll be about 24 people per year that would now pay under the bill and about 19 permits per year that would be exempt. So there's a little bit of a cross out going on here, but you can see the net effect on a bunch of different funds on the front page of the fiscal note. It's pretty small.
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment was actually brought to me in the midst of the policy committee debate. At that time, I didn't offer the amendment because I wanted to have time to have conversations with the stakeholders. After further conversations with them, they are okay with the amendment, and the DNR has requested that we put this amendment on, so is off asking for your support.
Okay, so Senator Scoy moves the A1 amendment. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay. Do you have anybody to testify?
No, unless the department wants to come up and say something. This has been an ongoing discussion that I've had. I think it's important for folks that live in amongst all this public land to not be overburdened with these fees as they bring power and phone and broadband into their home. So I would ask for your support for Senate File 945.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, DNR. Just briefly, we do support the bill. I've been trying to work with Senator Scoy and some of the utility companies to rectify some language that was passed that didn't do quite what it should have done in previous years. So this does resolve those issues. We'll work on updating that fiscal note, and the fiscal impact should be less than what's presented in that fiscal note right now.
Okay, so Senator Scoy, then we'll lay over Senate File 945 for inclusion in the omnibus bill, unless you want it to go by itself.
Whatever you'd like, Mr. Chair. It's got financial ramifications.
What would you like?
I hadn't even contemplated it moving on its own. I guess we could move it in two places.
Well, we could. But yeah, you better leave it here.
Better okay. Leave it.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right, thanks. Senator Sparks. Senate File 1158.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1158. As you know, soil and water conservation districts do great work implementing conservation measures. They provide technical expertise, but more importantly, they are trusted community members who are able to work with landowners on valued conservation projects. The issue of stable, long-term funding and establishing more equity among districts has long been an issue for the soil and water conservation districts. In working with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, we explored a number of options to address funding issues, and I hope we have arrived at one that will address our issues that the legislature can support. To that point, Mr. Chair, and before I turn it over to my testifier, I would like to move the A5 amendment. This amendment addresses concerns brought to us by the counties, and by making these changes, I believe that they will be in support of the current legislation.
Do you have anything left after this?
Not really.
Senator Sparks moves the A5 amendment. Senator Scoy. Did you have a question? I thought I heard you say something. Okay. All right. Any questions or comments on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion adopted. Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I would turn it over to my testifier to discuss the legislation and why it's important.
Okay. Go ahead and say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ian Cunningham,
And I serve as the president of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I'm also an elected local board member for the Pipestone SWCD. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on Senate File 1158. I'd especially like to thank Senator Sparks for his support and his work on this bill. Mr. Chair, I'd like to begin my comments with a very brief background on SWCDs and then get into the fiscal issues that we're facing, and finally how this bill addresses those issues through a general fund appropriation. Minnesota SWCDs are special purpose local units of state government established under state law, Minnesota Statute Chapter 103C, to carry on conservation programs at the local level. SWCDs are unique in their work. They work with private landowners to help them manage and protect land and water resources on all private lands. Each SWCD has a 5-member, locally elected Board of Supervisors to set policies, provide local input, and ensure oversight and accountability for the district. SWCDs provide tremendous state benefits, some seen, some unseen. Structural conservation practices are easy to see. Not so easy to see are the important management practices that SWCDs help landowners implement. Regardless of whether we see it or not, SWCD work is critical in making sure that all Minnesotans benefit through protection of our soils, lakes, streams, and rivers. None of our work is automatic or accidental. It must be planned for, promoted, funded, and installed every day across the state in cooperation with landowners and managers. As our state's soil and water resources face greater threats, the demands on SWCDs grow greater, and we are now the implementers that to make sure that our state stays on track with state and federal conservation programs. While the need has grown, it has not been coupled with the funding necessary to meet that need, which is why we are here today. Current SWCD funding falls short of providing necessary resources to meet our statutory obligations. Many SWCDs face volatility in their day-to-day operations due to varied funding at the county level and insufficient state resources. State resources that are available are mostly competitive in nature and directed at projects and practices rather than the people and expertise that it takes to make those projects happen. This creates an inadequate patchwork that severely limits our ability to meet established local and state priorities for managing our soil and water. Recognizing trouble on the horizon, our association convened an internal task force to look at SWCD funding issues and how we might solve them. We conducted outreach with various stakeholders, including organizations representing farmers, environmentalists, wildlife groups, the business community, as well as state and federal agencies and local government associations. Input was received through this outreach, shared a reflected recognition of the value of SWCDs and the need for additional funding. When we set out to actually quantify the need, an analysis by the Board of Soil and Water Resources has calculated the shortfall in local conservation delivery capacity of $22 million per year across all the SWCDs in the state. The bill before you provides $11 million per year in state funding to SWCDs in amounts that recognize the current county appropriation to the SWCD, provide an incentive but not a mandate that the counties contribute more to SWCDs. With the $11 million per year general fund appropriation, the state puts itself in the position of addressing half of the shortfall. This appropriation raises the lowest one-third of SWCDs to a level closer to adequate local capacity, providing some additional state support to the higher-performing SWCDs. It recognizes the current county funding, which is approximately $9.8 million, as a match, while providing incentives for counties to do more. This additional state investment will allow SWCDs to better meet the technical capacity needs and stay up to date with emerging conservation practices, provide better resources to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in lakes and rivers, and protect groundwater from degradation, build a solid base for key state and federal programs, and enhance opportunities to leverage conservation resources. Stabilize funding so SWCD can attract and retain soil and water resource professionals who assist private landowners with conservation practices. And enhance Minnesotans' quality of life through environmental, wildlife, and aesthetic benefits that come from conservation on private lands. Mr. Chair, committee members, again, thank you for your time and consideration today. Again, I want to thank Senator Sparks for his support. And at this time, I would be glad to take questions.
Any questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cunningham, for that testimony. I'm just wondering, in general, would you comment on the county share? It seems they're falling short here of funding for SWCDs. Can you comment on that? And how short do you think statewide average they are? Are some counties better than others, obviously, and they care more or maybe have more water resources to manage? Can you give me some comments as to if they're paying their share?
Mr. Cunningham.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, roughly speaking, there's about one-third of the SWCDs that are in a bad financial situation. The counties, the combination of county and other monies that fund SWCD operations are short. There's about another one-third that are doing okay financially, but up to 80% of their funding is soft money that could go away if they were unsuccessful in grants or certain programs that they're working would be cut. The other one-third, I think, are accomplishing good work with the resources they have, but would certainly be able to accomplish more if they had additional resources.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, SWCDs have taxing authority, and do they utilize that?
Cunningham.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, our legislative platform originally included the desire to get the elected board of soil and water conservation districts direct access to local funding, much like townships and school boards and other units of government that have elected boards have. We did not find the political will to bring that legislation forward this year. The general fund appropriation was our fallback position. So in the long run, we would like our elected board to have taxing authority, but that's not the issue that we're talking about today. So your answer to your question is no, we do not have taxing authority. It is very unusual that a special purpose unit of state government would have to rely on another unit of local government to levy on its behalf.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question, and thank you for doing this. I think the SWCDs have been woefully underfunded. The last, the allocation here, it talks about if the county does not give the money as they had promised to, do all counties get these natural resources block grants that could be decreased?
That is my understanding, and in many cases, the SWCD is delegated to carry out some, but not always all of those programs.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further questions, Senator? Oh, Senator Scully, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I get an understanding, the first $40,000 that would go to each soil water conservation district has no match. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then the next $50,000 is a match of $1 of county to $1.25 of state. And then, Mr. Chair, anything above that would be 65 cents to $1. And why not on the first $40,000? I was just curious what the rationale was there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, the first $40,000 is to attempt to raise all boats. The next amount of money is to recognize the county contribution. So if in counties that have a low, who levy on behalf of their soil and water conservation districts, a small amount, the $40,000 with no strings attached helps a lot. And then the first $40,000 worth of county investment is matched at 1.5 2.5 to 1, so that would be another $50,000 of state investment, and then over that it's a smaller match. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I guess so. I was curious as to why we wouldn't have the counties providing even a small match on the first amount. I mean, if you're not funded adequately, I mean, if the county was going to get $40,000, you'd think they'd at least put five in or something, you know. But I guess if you don't figure that's necessary, maybe not.
We can work on that. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was my concern as well. I just didn't see any skin in the game until later on, and I'm just concerned about that. So I'd like to work on that as well.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Anybody else need to testify?
No.
Okay. Then Senator Sparks will lay over Senate File 1158 for inclusion of comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Marty. Senate File 1515. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1515 is a compromise, or I guess I use the word consensus, but I think nobody's thrilled with the bill, but it's a bill related to wetland conservation. Last year, because of some concerns about the issue, I think Senator Scoy was actually the one who came before our committee, and we talked about how contentious this issue is always and has been and so on. And based on that, both Senator Scoy and myself and I think some others of you asked folks, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, to come together and bring stakeholders together and try to work things out. They had a huge group meeting all summer, and in the end, not coming to any kind of agreement. The governor's office pulled together some stakeholders. They put together a bill. When we presented it in my committee, there was lots of testimony about we wish it was this way, we wish it was that way. It's now a bipartisan bill that I hope makes steps forward. And it does several things that I think are important, one of which is in Section 1 of the bill, it asks Bowser to pull together a stakeholder process on an ongoing basis to try and make further changes, because I think several of the people testifying said this was a small step forward, and I think that's very important. This bill does not solve all the issues, but it does try and continue the process moving forward. Second of all, it sets up a prioritization process. If you cannot mitigate wetlands in the area, set up what priorities are. Third, it gives more alternatives for how you can mitigate wetlands, including they could pay a fee in lieu of doing the restoration themselves, so either Bowser or some third party could come in and do the work for them. And the goal is, first of all, to try and continue to focus on the priority of not disturbing wetlands, but where they have to, try and make sure we do the most effective work to replace it. And again, we're trying very hard to keep this fragile compromise together, and so I could tell you lots of things I don't like in the bill. I think most everybody who was involved in the stakeholder process can tell you things they don't like in the bill, but I'll have Mr. Warrens from Board of Water and Soil Resources go through the bill, and I'd ask for your consideration.
So, and Senator Marty, there must be a group that is not happy with stuff that's not in the bill. Is that
that's
correct?
That's true too, Mr. Chair. There are lots of people who are very happy with things not in the bill as well.
Unhappy.
Yes, they're very unhappy with things that aren't in the bill
yes,
as well.
Okay, all right, okay. All right, go ahead. Say your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Wyrens. I'm Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Senator Marty did an excellent job providing an overview of the bill. I think if the committee wishes to kind of walk through it section by section, if that's what the inclination is, to describe what is in the bill, what's it doing. I can also speak to the fiscal implication of the provisions kind of as we go along as well.
Why don't you just describe the bill, but put emphasis on the fiscal implication as long as we're here for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first section, as Senator Marty indicated, wetland stakeholder coordination. This will be a new process the board would establish to have an ongoing discussion among stakeholders so that we can come forward on a more regular basis with policy changes that really have the opportunity to have a long discussion, hopefully consensus like we have here, at least in part. It's something that's been modeled on the drainage work group that Bowser currently administers and has been very successful in trying to move those policy discussions along. Now, this is a case that will be a fiscal impact here. I mean, our staff will be responsible for organizing and coordinating this group and of course, then bringing their suggestions through the administration and through the legislative process as the case might be. Section 2 provides for a new way to improve the targeting of wetland replacement where we establish these high priority areas. The point being is right now when it comes to restoring areas to generate wetland credit to offset unavoidable impacts, people can find land wherever they can find land that's most cost effective for them. Our goal here is to try and provide incentives to direct people to do those restorations, to do that kind of work in ways that have watershed benefits so that there's some statewide public benefit and some public value. It's not going to be mandatory, but the idea is to create incentives for folks to kind of go to certain areas instead of where they can find some mitigation. And this likewise will have some effort on the part of the board. The criterion process for establishing high priorities will be within rule that we'll have to undertake that process following the presumption of enactment, and then the management of high priority areas long-term in the future will have some cost on the part of the board as we go forward with that. Section 3 is a conforming amendment with the change in Section 2. There's nothing really new going on there. It's just to make sure that existing statute regarding a property tax reduction program that counties can use is consistent with the changes in Section 2. Section 4 is a definition of an indoor fee program. There's more detail on what that program is later on, and I'll discuss that in a little more detail once we get to those provisions of the bill. In Section 5, looking at page 4 to start there, the initial change is to delete and add some language that ties into, again, something that Senator Marty mentioned, to allow alternative actions to generate wetland credit. We need to make a modification here to ensure that non-wetland actions that can get wetland credit are allowed under law. And Section 5 is, again, to ensure that we're consistent throughout the bill as we go.
Excuse me, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, we're just past number 2, but can you explain a little more, what is a high priority wetland replacement area?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, what we are suggesting for a high priority area for wetland replacement is to go through and looking at existing plans like the prairie plan that the DNR has established. We would talk to local governments through their local water plans to identify areas that would have particular value for the local environment to do a restoration project to generate wetland credit. So we work through a process of consulting with other agencies as well as with local governments on where we should designate these areas to create incentives. Again, the idea being is that perhaps the replacement ratio would be lower if you're using credits that are established in those areas as opposed to going someplace else. Does that help answer your question?
Sort of. Sort of. So it's areas that once were wetlands and you're replacing them now, or re-establishing, and then there would be credits for offsetting some other project where they might impact a wetland?
To this point, Senator Scully, or you want to?
After Mr. Wyrens, I think I can help answer the question.
Mr. Wyrens.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, the preferred way to offset a wetland impact is to restore a wetland someplace else. So certainly what we would look to do is to identify what are the needs of a given small watershed and to try and direct restoration projects to those areas that will benefit the local watershed but also provide the necessary wetland credits.
Mr. Chair, in our summary, we're looking at, it's called West Wetland Replacement, which to me, I view that different than wetland restoration, but are they one and the same? Maybe Senator Scoy has some insight on this.
Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Westrom, I think if we could get to kind of what the purpose of the bill is, and Senator Marty mentioned that I was appeared in front of his committee last year. This is an issue that's driven by current state requirements that the mitigation occur within the watershed district where the impact is occurring. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is some of the mitigation is occurring in areas which have 80 to 90% of their pre-settlement wetlands there. They're kind of struggling around to find a quality mitigation in those areas.
Okay.
So what the discussion has been is, well, rather than forcing these mitigations into these spots where they really aren't adding much value, maybe we could look outside the area of the watershed district into these high priority areas. And the example I'll use is in the Red River Valley. We're doing a number of initiatives to try to do flood damage reduction. It's a very high priority for the Red River Valley. Instead of doing mitigation where it isn't doing much good, maybe we can do some of this wetland mitigation on these flood damage reduction areas. They're high priority. They would actually be very much more beneficial. They would be a much higher wetland impacts, and they also would do flood reduction benefits. So that was kind of the initial purpose, and this high priority is now determined by, I don't know, the local boards or whatever, but when my original take on this was is, you know, we've done a stack of studies around the state over the years to determine where these, you know, where there's been wetland loss and where we should try to do restorations or replacements, and trying to line up the mitigation with those plans.
So Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, just to kind of recap what I think you've said, and I think that makes sense. Like up in your district where there's some land or areas that are high percentage of wetlands or wetland area, adding to them may not make a lot of sense. It's not much as much value necessarily as if you get over to the Ada or the Crookston or the Moorhead or the Breckenridge area where you know you're going to have some flooding issues, especially in the spring, and if you can restore something that would also serve as flood mitigation, that would be a higher priority. Am I kind of following you right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weston, yes, that's exactly right. And the issue then develops around from some of the stakeholders. It was real important to those stakeholders that the mitigation occur in a geographic area close to the project. They didn't like the idea that we were moving these potentially outside of the area that being impacted by the project. So that's part of the compromise that's been going on here, and that hence this project or this definition for determining high priority areas is in play in this bill.
And thank you, Senator Skoy, Mr. Chairman. It just hopefully that's helpful to other committee members as you continue through, because I was reading this and I thought, what are we talking about? So thank you. You can continue.
Mr. Chair and Senator Weston, it particularly affects my Aiken County. Aiken County is 65% wetlands. We have 700,000 acres of wetlands. So it really doesn't make much sense to us. We're always the target of wetland mitigation because we have it and they, you know, it's a great place to make more, but we really in our tax base don't need to have more wetlands, and it really doesn't make sense to put more wetlands there where in the Red River Basin it would make a great amount of sense to do that. So I think that's what this is trying to accomplish.
And Senator Rudin, I got the same issue in my district, and Senator Westrom, the issue becomes sometimes they can't find places to mitigate wetlands in areas where there's 80% wetlands already. So it's very, very difficult sometimes.
So sometimes, Mr. Chairman, you need to go outside of the area.
Yes, so I think this is a common sense solution. But yeah. Senator Skoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, as long as we're having this good conversation, I'd like to add one more thing. The problem with what we just detailed is the cost of the land is significantly higher in those areas where the need is greater. So that's partly the
offsets.
Well, yeah, the offsets, and also this in-lieu fee program, how that gets developed is going to be important, because I think that'll be the mechanism that will be utilized within Bowser to determine where the best use of the dollars are and how to, you know, equalize that land value differential. I don't know exactly how the stakeholder groups has resolved that, but I'd guess that's a issue that somebody's got to be talking about and working on.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, you still?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was, seems like we're on the same page today, Senator Squire. I was asking about it. I know there's going to be a disparity, a difference in cost of land in the Red River Valley versus in Aiken County or in the northeast section of the state. I'm not sure how they're going to come to that. But there was at one time talked about a two-for-one. So 1 acre, you'd absorb 1 acre on this end, and you'd be required to go out and restore 2 acres. Is that still involved here at all, or was there ever discussions about that?
It's a Senator Marty question.
Well, I can start the answer.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if you're in a county that has more than 80% of your pre-sediment wetlands, it's a 1-to-1 restoration. Other areas are 2-to-1. I don't exactly know how this piece of legislation is impacting that. I think Mr. Wirens would be the one to.
Either one of you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, we're not changing ratios here, and Senator Scoy has been doing a good job of explaining this. But,
I was going to say, this is pretty easy for you to come in here and everybody else. So
this question is directed at Senator Marty, yes.
Mr. Chair, we're trying to focus, and Mr. Wirens, as he was going through the bill, was going to talk about one of the things we hope to do in the areas like Senator Tomasoni's, where it's hard to find replacement things. There are other things we can do with buffers, with protection of streams, doing other things to do to help protect the watershed. And I think that's what the bill is, that's on page 12, trying to do that. But we're trying to do it's trying to put together a logical process of trying to, when you can't avoid, as the first goal is to avoid disrupting wetlands, when you can't try and do things to help locally, whether it's wetlands mitigation or other things to enhance the watershed. And if you can't do that, then you go elsewhere. And when you're going elsewhere, we want it to be a higher priority project rather than just because it's someplace you could find some acres to restore.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, and this really makes a lot of sense, because there's certain areas where we need more holding capacity. I'm wondering how far can you go? Could you go, if you had a project in the northeast, could you go as far as the southwest, where we've experienced flooding because there's not enough holding capacity and it's been drained?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, the short answer is no, you cannot go from northeast to far southwest. The way that the current rule provides for is that you can go to the next adjacent bank service area. Think of a basin area like the Upper Mississippi River, for instance. You can move to those ones, but you can never get that far away to go that far away. This also bears another point that's important to keep in mind. We're also always in the, I'll say, forefront of our mind on these, is trying to maximize how we coordinate what's under state law and what's under the Clean Water Act that the Corps of Engineers administers. One of the real challenges here is to try and minimize differences, because that makes it real difficult for project proposers to try and go through two different processes that regulate the same impact. So we work very closely with the Corps of Engineers on the Clean Water responsibilities, and they also would not allow you to go from St. Louis County to Rock County. That would not be possible under federal regulations either.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then it just seems to me that we've looked at this problem in the last couple of years. So you're sort of limited if you're talking about adjacent counties. So you've got a ring of counties, which would be like Aiken County, Lake of the Woods, Beltran, those kinds of counties that don't really need any more wetlands because they have so many and want to keep a certain amount of land still in production rather than wet. So then what's the answer? Do you go beyond those ring counties then, or do you just go to those ring counties and create more wetlands where they don't want them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, there really are a couple of answers to that particular question. First, and as Senator Marty mentioned, when you have to offset an impact, trying replacement for an impact, you're always required to start like in the same minor watershed and move kind of further out in concentric rings. That's a requirement. So you first have to look. If you can't find sites, then you keep moving further and further out. One way to try and keep some of those wetland functions in that close-in area, in that small watershed, is this provision that's in Section 11 that allows for these alternative credit actions, where you restore streams, where you establish riparian buffers, these sorts of actions, so that you keep some of those aquatic functions in that watershed. They're not wetlands, because maybe you can't find wetlands, has been mentioned already, but you other things that have environmental and aquatic benefits, try and keep some of those sorts of things going out in the area. But those aren't always possible either. So the place where the high priorities come in place, that as you move further out, once you leave the bank service area, which would be the Lake Superior watershed and the Rainy River, once you move beyond that, then we would use incentives to try and direct people to these high priority areas. Don't just go anywhere, but to try and direct them to areas that have a higher watershed benefit, that meet local needs and address the wetland functions that are desirable within those areas.
Senator Ubert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll be opening a can of worms here. So if we're going to go someplace else to do mitigation, would you call a 50-foot buffer strip a good mitigation idea? And I'll follow that up with a question of how much, when we talk about mitigating a and that's a serious question, when you're talking about mitigating going out into a different area, going out into the Red River Valley, for instance, how would that work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the current program, if a wetland is being restored to provide the replacement, we do require there to be a buffer around the wetland area. And you do receive wetland credit for those areas. Not at the same amount as for the wetland area, but you get credit for that because the purpose of the buffer is to protect the wetland that is being restored. So we do allow credit for those areas as well that are around wetlands.
So to a follow-up, so this is kind of it's a minuscule amount of land when the governor comes out with this 50-foot buffer strip, for instance. That's a lot of property. This wouldn't even dent that. So this wouldn't allow a big company like Target to come in and put up a place in Aiken County, and they would have to mitigate come up with X amount of acres of mitigation, go out into the Red River Valley. How many acres would they be required to mitigate if it was determined that buffer strips are a good mitigation for floods? Is it something that's just not even on the sheets?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, under the current way the wetland conservation being implemented, buffers all by themselves outside of, again, looking on page 12 of the bill, that's language there, if you're outside of that northeast third of the state, a buffer all by itself is not going to get you, will not get any sort of replacement credit. But if you're in northeast Minnesota where they don't have other options, I mean, the idea behind this is that if you can't find a wetland to offset wetland impact, then these other options, which might be a buffer along a stream, in those cases, you might get credit for those. And that's one of the key issues we have to determine is how much wetland credit is a mile of restored and a stream worth. We don't have those answers yet, but that's part of the process we do through rulemaking and consulting with, again, the broad range of stakeholders who we engage when we're talking about, these sorts of wetland matters.
Hey, Mr. Burns, why don't you get to the fiscal impacts here?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe to kind of skip through the bill a little bit here to talk about some of those other factors that I think are important to talk about. The next thing I draw your attention to is on page 9, where we talk about in section 7, another area that's going to require really quite a bit of work in establishing an in-lieu fee program. And what this is, the term in-lieu fee means that in lieu of doing the restoration work yourself, you're paying a fee to somebody else to do that work for you. That's a term of art. It is derived from, again, the Federal Mitigation Rule developed under the Clean Water Act Section 404 program. The purpose of the program of this program is to provide another option for wetland replacement. If you go through the process and you can't find replacement close by, you can't find a wetland bank to buy credits from, then you can write a check to cover your mitigation responsibility, and it could be to Bowser. You know, the board could do that. We could hire it to a third party group as well. But then we'd be on the hook. We'd be responsible for using that money to establish, you know, quality, sustainable wetlands where they provide for watershed needs. And then those then would provide that mitigation. In terms of the fiscal impact, we're going to be responsible for running the NLFI program. But first, before we even get there, though, we have to write the rule that provides the details for it so everybody knows how those operate. And we also have to, on a parallel track, negotiate an agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers. Because, again, the point being is if someone's going to use the NLFI program to offset impacts under state law, want them to count under federal as well so that it's a consistent approach. So there will be some effort there on the part of the board in the next 1 to 2 years to do the rules, to do the agreement with the Corps of Engineers, and then long-term there will be the management of the NLFI program, which will be the accepting of money and then the going out and identifying and building restored areas to offset impacts that the money is collected for. That will be a significant amount of work there. Another piece of a fiscal impact, if you flip over to Section 8, the operative language is on page 10, that new paragraph C. One other thing that we intend to do to try and help what the mitigation happen is establish what we're calling a rapid response team, where we bring in experts from federal, state, and local agencies to work with project proposers before they spend a lot of time and money on a wetland bank site to make sure that it's going to be a good site. It's going to be quality, it's going to be sustainable, and it's going to be locally accepted. We want all those to be part of it. And the purpose of the rapid response team is to give advice early on to make sure it's going to meet those objectives, again, before an applicant spends a lot of time and money on projects. Wetland banking is a very expensive proposition to, in fact, go through, and we want people to spend their money well in that regard.
To this point, Mr. Chair, thank you. So tell me what a rapid response is for one of these programs when you have the Army Corps of Engineer involved.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingberts, this is before the actual permitting process would in fact occur. So we expect that we could call this group together within a month of knowing that there's a project that some value could be offered to. But the actual permitting process would start after this happens.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the whole point is to make sure the project proposer doesn't say, we got to do this, now we start charging ahead trying to do something, and then they find out that's not going to accomplish what is required to be done. Giving them advice up front can help them steer their work in a way that does it. And that's the same thing with the NLU fee program. If the project proposer, we're not experts in wetland stuff, we want somebody else to do it, they would put money into that fee, and they probably deal with, I mean, Nature Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited, other groups like that that are good at doing that would be likely the ones that would be actually doing the projects. And somebody who knows what they're doing might be more efficient at doing it than the business that's coming in proposing this project. And so the whole point of this is to try and make sure if somebody's going to be investing money in wetlands mitigation, let's make sure it's done as well as and efficiently as possible.
Mr. Chair, I certainly understand that, Senator. The rapid response thing is rather, you know, questionable. But I understand the concept of yep. the business knowing that and wanting that information before they go ahead and obviously go ahead and proceed.
I suppose we should get a definition of rapid. Is it a month? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 2 years?
Generally six.
Maybe just delete rapid.
Well, perhaps, Mr. Chair, we'll give it a different name going forward, perhaps.
Okay, that's a good idea.
The next section with the fiscal impact is Section 10 on page 11 of the bill. The deletion of banking plan, what that in fact does is currently over 300 local UCOVs across the state really do the lion's share of the work of the Conservation Act. And that includes the approval and oversight of wetland banking plans. What we're suggesting here is that we'd make a change to that process where the board would take over the responsibility of approving wetland banking plans, specifically focusing on the issues related to the design, the construction, the vegetation standards are being established to make sure, again, that those wetlands that are being restored are going to provide, you know, are going to be quality and sustainable into the long term. The local government will still be involved on the siting part of the decision, but the technical aspects of the bank plan are something that the board would be more directly responsible for than we currently are under current law. If you flip over to section 11, the new language on the top half of page 12, this is the alternative credit action language. And the idea here behind this is where wetlands cannot be restored because they don't exist, it's not practical to, in fact, do that, to try to retain some of those aquatic functions in the local area is to provide some other actions that can be done to kind of keep those functions in close. So the way this is laid out here is just providing another option only in parts of the state that really have a demonstrated need where they can't find restorable wetlands to offset, allow other things to happen to keep those functions within those watersheds. Again, this is a provision that will require work in the coming months to make it implementable through a rulemaking process.
Senator Sexton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Wierens, on page 12, lines 11 through 13, I know what I obviously know what streams and riparian buffer is. How do we define a habitat corridor?
Mr. Wierens.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhog, I assume aware there's been some conversation over that term in recent days. We've done some further work to try and better define what that in fact means. I think a more general definition I would start with is that it's a link of wildlife habitat. Generally, native vegetation which joins two or more larger areas of similar wildlife habitat. For purposes of this provision, there'd have to be a riparian connection the way the language is written.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Warrens, just kind of give me an example. Is this a peninsula of land or just kind of give me an example of what it might be?
Well, it certainly could be a peninsula of land. I think what it would be is it would be an area that would have to, again, have a connection to a wetland, to a stream. We have to be careful to get too far out into the upland. Certainly one thing that we've not gotten into great amount of detail at this point in time in defining what that in fact is, but I think, you know, the way that we would approach this is that we certainly would use technical experts identifying what these are. We'd talk to DNR, of course, and their staff, local governments. What we'd be looking for is areas that would either be restored in areas where they don't exist, or the preserved, if identified, is important and under a threat. Again, the point being is to protect areas if land is going to be developed for some fashion, a way to protect it. And again, the idea being is to provide habitat connections for wildlife that have a connection to aquatic resources, wetlands, lakes, rivers.
Senator Dietzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would the I have the Mississippi River, and there's the little mini islands on there where the heron rookery is. Would that be a habitat corridor, or would the whole Mississippi River, which is the flyway, be a habitat corridor?
Mr. Chair and Senator Jesus, we're thinking these are likely to be smaller areas than the examples that you're suggesting. They would not be such large expanses. And again, I remind the committee, these are only for areas that would be generating replacement credit, and they typically are fairly small areas at that as well.
Senator Dietrich.
I was giving those examples because I think the flyway is a large area that's where, you know, this might need to be more tightly defined because, you know, there might be pockets in there where you could have some wetland credits and maybe some trade-offs, but... You know, if you just talk a habitat corridor, somebody may view that flyway as it's a habitat, it's a corridor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, yeah, that's what they're going to be dealing with in rule process and so on to make sure we're not. The point of this is to deal with the wetlands. We're trying to preserve as much as we can, the best way we can, come up with the best alternative. So So they don't want to do it just huge wildlife. Your example, yeah, it might be a narrow spot, but we're talking about replacing a particular weight, destroying of a wetland. How are we going to replace its values in the best way possible? It's not meant to be making wetlands dollars be going for wildlife habitat. It's related to wetlands laws.
Senator Spock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wirens, so let me think about this Habitat for Corridor. So you've got a little slough or a small pond in the woods and a little creek flowing to another one, and there happens to be some stream bank erosion on that little creek. And in order to mitigate the water quality, they go in and do some stream bank restoration to keep the sediment from washing into the creek. Is it kind of, am I getting along to what the thoughts are with regard to this alternative mitigation? You're doing water quality restoration by doing some stream bank stabilization and buffer strips. Is that kind of what thinking along here? And then I'm going to follow up with that if that's accurate.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, that certainly is part of what this provision is getting at, you know, in terms of doing stream restorations. That would receive credit, but strictly speaking, that's not part of the habitat corridor. Certainly, as part of a project, you could do a stream restoration and have a strip of land that serves as a corridor between two other wildlife populations. You know, that could be one entire project where you're bundling a series of these actions to generate the wetland credit that you're looking for. That certainly is possible, and actually would probably be a desirable outcome, quite honestly, for that sort of project to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Aron. So then you've got the corridor, the wildlife corridor, and their logging job is going on, and there's trees on both sides of the corridor. What do they do for going across it?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, I'd be surprised if our standards that we would develop would allow any kind of a you're talking about a stream crossing of some sort. If I'm understanding what your question is, we would probably not authorize or an alteration along those lines to cross a given river.
Well, Mr. Chair, so Mr. Wirens, how would the management, the silviculture occur on the other side of the corridor if you can't cross it?
Well, Chair Senator Scoia, are you referring to the wildlife to be able to cross the...
No, I'm talking about the logger. I mean, there's going to be high land with trees growing on it on both sides of this corridor. They're going to start a logging job, and they're going to... How are they going to get across that corridor to get at the trees on the other side?
Well, Mr. Chair Senator Scoia, there are current standards that timber producers have to follow when they're crossing by water. My understanding that it's not prohibited because they are temporary impacts, that they go in the middle of the crossing, they restore it after they're done with their work, and then the site kind of goes from there, is my understanding. So a timber harvesting would not be prohibited under this or under current law.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's the question, isn't it?
Just a couple of questions. One comment, a question. Habitat corridors have been around for quite a while, actually, and basically it's just a corridor for habitat, for nesting and for migration, and we've talked about it a lot with the DNR, and I think they've got some pretty good explanations of that, but nesting and all staying, you know, when acquisitions go on or fee title acquisitions go on, that they kind of go in a corridor similar to the Mississippi River, but in the western part of the state where the land has been compromised. The question that I have is, I'm going to go back to that cost of the evaluation, the quick response team. What comes with the cost to that?
Mr. Chair and
page 10. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Page 10. The rapid response team. Is there going to be a large cost to that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, there would not be a large cost of that. And just mentioning that there would be some responsibility for on part of Bowser staff to organize and manage and to participate in that group, but it would not be a large cost, no.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the other thing has a fiscal impact. Again, looking at Section 12 at the bottom of the page, there is a fee provided for in there. Currently, for all wetland banks that are established, there's a requirement for there to be a perpetual easement placed over that land area. We're proposing to institute a fee to recover our costs for going through that recording process for the easement. In the fiscal note, we're estimating a cost of approximately $2,000, but certainly we will find that further before we establish what that fee is and that gets in fact improved. But there'd be an implication there.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, the last thing that I will mention is Section 14 has a report. There is a requirement that the board report back to the legislature next March on a series of topics that are contained within this bill. Essentially, it's an update of the work we've done between now and then on the work we're doing to implement the provisions of this legislation.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Are there any other questions or comments then? Okay. Do you have anybody else testify, Senator Marty?
No. Mr. Chair, no. There may be others who wish to, but I didn't.
Does anybody else wish to testify? Mr. Grant?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Timber Producers Association, Minnesota Forest Industries. It's my second time today testifying next to Senator Marty on one of his bills.
Agreeing with him?
Oh, the last one, yeah. Yeah, the last one, yeah. Yeah, really that was a good bill. That's a good bill you got there. I have one specific question that goes to the question that Senator Saxhog raised, and that is the on lines 12-12 and then 13-5, the habitat corridors. My members certainly understand the need for greater replacement options in the greater than 80% counties, which is where most of the forest land on which we operate in the state is. We understand restoration and protection of streams, riparian buffers, the example that Senator Skoy used. But we didn't, and I'm not sure we still do, understand what is contemplated with the habitat corridors. So I contacted Mr. Jasky from Bowser last week asking him that question. He got back to me very promptly, or his staff did, with that. So, what they pointed me towards in their email on the corridor was language, and I'll just read it to you. A wildlife corridor is a link of wildlife habitat, generally native vegetation, which joins two or more larger areas of similar wildlife habitat. Corridors are critical for the maintenance of ecological processes, including allowing for the movement of animals and the continuation of viable populations. So, I don't think there's any way to read that other than that that's upland areas. I don't think that's a wet area or even contemplated to be a wet area under the bill. So the board further, sent me some information saying that, before implementation of this alternative replacement could take place, that they would rely on appropriate technical experts, DNR wildlife managers, to help identify potential corridors. They go on to say the corridors would either be restored in areas where they don't exist or preserved if identified as important and under a demonstrable threat. So preserved under the language of the bill and the act includes fee title purchase of uplands in counties where we have substantial public ownership already, or acquisition of conservation easements on those lands. And the bill is pretty specific to that on page 10, lines 10.35, continuing on to 11.1, and this is, what they can do with the in-lieu program. And we think the in-lieu program makes some sense for getting out of the box that, as a state, we're in on replacement. But at the end of 10 there, on 10.35, the board may acquire land in fee title purchase or accept easements, and then it goes on. So the communication I got from the board also then went on to say that, forest management activities would be fine so long as Bowser approved them. So, we got county land departments, we've got the DNR involved in forest management, and, our concern is that now, it's kind of several fold. Now, this would have Bowser in a management role in forested uplands, and frankly, we have a concern, having been involved in the Wetland Conservation Act since it was originally passed, that the habitat corridors You know, and everything is linked to everything. You know, we all know that, that, you know, from the streams to the wetlands, to the uplands and the drainage. I'm not sure that you would approve replacement credits for seeding the clouds to get it to rain to replenish the water courses and the wetlands, which is maybe a bit facetious. But, you know, giving replacement credits in upland areas just seems kind of a step too far to us in terms of the values and the actions that have always been intended in this. You know, we understand, you know, what's trying to be accomplished here. We understand, you know, we were part of the larger stakeholder group, not invited to be in the smaller stakeholder group that put this bill together. It's certainly not our intention to attempt to scuttle the bill in any way, shape, or form, but you know, we're not getting very satisfactory answers about, and I think you've seen this yourselves, about the habitat corridor language. We would be vastly more comfortable with the bill if those two words in the two places were ultimately removed. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
Sure, Mr. Mobley.
All right. Okay. Anybody else want to say anything? All right. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Mr. Wirens or Senator Marty, maybe, why is this provision then limited to just the greater than 80% areas?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, the reasons for that being is that, generally speaking, everywhere else in the state, there are wetlands that can be restored to offset wetland impacts. There are a large amount of areas of state that have been drained that are potentially restorable. In northeast Minnesota, there is a particular need to retain certain aquatic functions in northeast that might not be wetlands because they don't exist. The wetlands in northeast Minnesota that have been drained or filled, they tend to have a building or a road on top of them. I mean, that's about what the case is by and large up there. And then the point being is that where a wetland restoration is not a practical option, it seems prudent to allow other options to the alternative of exporting those wetland functions outside of that northeast third of the state, which is currently occurring.
Mr. Chair, just one last question. I'm just happy. So you keep referring to the northeast corner of the state. Does this bill only refer to that part of the state, or does it pertain to all the counties in the state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, when I'm referring to northeast Minnesota, that's short for the greater than 80% area of the state, which is defined in the Conservation Act, and it's against roughly those northeast third of the counties. This provision in Section 11 really only does apply to that area of the state. The rest of the bill would apply statewide.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Wyron, so in the counties in the center part of the state that still have 80% of their pre-settlement wetlands, they would be eligible for this. But if you got farther west where they didn't, then they would not.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, you are correct. The greater 80% area does come down and include, gets down to Cass, Crowing. I believe Morrison County is also in that greater 80% area, Kennebec. Kind of more to the east. You know, those are some of the counties on that kind of western edge. I believe Douglas County going further to the west.
Okay. All right. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Harnack with the Red River Watershed Management Board. It's a joint powers of watershed districts in the Red River Valley. And I have had the opportunity to be involved with the stakeholder group. We believe this legislation is a significant advancement for the Wetland Conservation Act. The in-lieu fee process, the establishment of high-priority areas, I think will significantly move us in the direction of providing greater public value in wetland mitigation and replacement than currently exists under the law we have in place today. There certainly are some things that if we were king for a day, we would probably advocate a little bit different, but I think everybody that would stand up here might say the same thing. One of the things that we hope is that this legislation does not rely too much on what 404 says. I think the state needs to be given, through this process, great flexibility to establish rules that we think are best for Minnesota. And the Environmental Protection Agency, with the Clean Water Act, did not specifically set forth real specific limitations. That has all evolved through rule and through guidance that comes through EPA and through the Corps of Engineers. And I think we need to provide the greatest amount of flexibility to Bowser and to the stakeholder group so that we can achieve the best return on our investment for wetland mitigation going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Harnack? Senator Westrom. Senator Westrom.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I guess not specifically to Mr. Harnack, but just in general, and to Senator Scoy's question, I guess I'd be tempted to lower that number of 80% to some other number. 80% is a big portion of a county, and so I don't know, Mr. Chair, if we could look at 50% or some other number that would include more counties that might. I mean, if you have 50% of your county in wetlands, that's a lot of tax base. To Senator Rood's earlier point, she was at 65%. So I don't know if now if we could do that, Mr. Chair, or others, but I just I'm getting that sense as we continue to hear testimony.
Let me have Mr. Knopf clarify what 80% means. Yeah.
Mr. Chair? Go ahead, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom. When we refer to 80%, there's actually a definition. It's 80% of the pre-settlement wetlands. It's not 80% of the county is wetland. It means that there's 80% of the pre-settlement wetlands that still exist that have not been drained or filled. So it's a little different. I mean, there are counties where we have more than 80% of wetland in the county, but that's not what this addresses. It's those that have their pre-settlement. We have another category of 50 to 80, and then we have the less than 50. But it's of your pre-settlement wetlands. It's not the total amount of acreage that's wet. It's of your original acreage of pre-European settlements.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
I was going to change the subject.
Oh.
But we're still on this matter.
Is it on anything that we just already heard, or should we hear the testifier first?
If Mr. Carlson is talking about what we're talking about right now, we can go to him.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and two of my members, St. Louis County and Crow Wing County, are in the greater than 80% area. And with regards to Mr. Brandt's comments on the language on 12-11-12-12, speaking from the county's multiple roles in the areas of wetland conservation, but specifically in our role as constructors of roads and other public works projects, we welcome the flexibility that is offered by this language. I understand the concern that Mr. Brandt raises, and we would certainly welcome an alternative where we could do the replacements in other than the wetland banks areas where the impact is located, but because of concerns within the other organizations that participate in the stakeholders groups, as our organization did, I guess that's not possible at this time. So we would encourage you to maintain the flexibility that's provided by the current language.
So you consider habitat corridors to be flexible? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Why?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we're limited to just streams and riparian buffers, that's a relatively narrow area. Certainly, it's an enhancement on what's available to us now that we can only do wetland replacements with other wetlands, but the habitat corridors would give us further flexibility. Like I said, you know, if the committee the stakeholders group at some future point could find the ability for these priority areas to include areas that are outside the immediate wetlands banks area, that would be a preferable alternative from our point of view. But until that point is reached, this grants us some flexibility that's not available right now.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's somewhat related. It has to do with the language that is being struck in Section 6. But if you look over on lines 8.7 to 8.15, having to do with transportation projects. I was out of the room, so I don't know if this was covered in much detail, but I asked Mr. Rudin. He said it was not. So, Senator Marty, if I could just understand a little bit better what we're accomplishing by striking this language, and then I had some a specific question about paragraph B there that's being struck, 8.13 to 8.15.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, there's a couple reasons why that language you're referring to, that paragraph 5, is stricken in here. The first reason is that by following the language here, you're following county boundaries, and we think it's preferable to move the management of this law more closely to the watershed approach. I think it has advantages to the other environmental activities that the state's undertaking. It also helps us match it better with the Corps of Engineers. It provides those multiple benefits of the geography of how we manage these sorts of things. And that really is a primary purpose for why we are proposing to delete this language.
Senator Drew.
And then, Mr. Chair, the 2-to-1 replacement is being eliminated, or am I not understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, the replacement ratios exist elsewhere in statute for the 50-80% areas and less than 50% areas. It's a 2-to-1 base ratio, so that's not affected by this. If you're in the greater than 80%, the base ratio is 1-to-1. That those are not changed by this language.
Great, thank you.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
And then I just briefly spoke with the Department of Transportation. And they indicate that they still have replacement credits and are hoping they could continue to use them. This language would not allow them to do that. Are we going to be able to revisit the language that we strike in paragraph B to allow them to take advantage of the effort they've already gone to, the expense and the effort they've already gone to for wetland replacement credits?
Mr. Sure. Chair and Senator Dibble, we've had conversations the last couple of days with the Department of Transportation, and we work with them to restore language that allows the utility of those credits that would be affected by the deletion of this language.
Senator Dibble.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that assurance, I won't ask for this bill to come to the Transportation Committee, but maybe, Senator Marty, if we could stay in communication.
Please.
Don't want to drag you through transportation, but this is a fairly significant transportation provision. I was surprised to see it crop up here.
Okay. All right. With that, anybody else? Be urged to testify. All right. Then, Senator Marty, I guess we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, with that, thank you, everybody. And if there are no more questions, I don't see any. We'll lay over Senate File 1515.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
All right, then.
I'm coming in.
Meeting adjourned.
They all just got to tell me. Well,